Among the words that get used a lot in the United States today, drone must rank very high on that list. Once upon a time, we used the term to refer to bees and ants. But then the word got slapped on what the military calls UAVs, or unmanned aerial vehicles. This is the weapon of choice in the American arsenal. To many people, drones represent a low-risk, high-reward kind of warfare. Just take out the targets you want, and even if things go wrong, you don't lose a pilot. Our guest this hour says it's not nearly that simple. William Arkin's book is Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. William Arkin spent 40 years in national security, starting with an Army intelligence posting in West Berlin during the Cold War. He is a former national security consultant to the New York Times and the author of more than a dozen books, including American Coup and Top Secret America, co-authored with Dana Priest. William M. Arkin, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So 50 Predator drones in the air on any given day, you say, but those are just the Predators. How many total in American military service do you figure are flying on any day?
Well, it's hard to say today because, of course, we're not at war, and yet we are at war, which is to say that tomorrow we could be bombing one of nine countries, which is where we're currently hunting terrorists. And there are U.S. military operations and CIA operations which are separately going on, all involving drones, not just Predator drones, but Predator sort of has become the way to describe this Cessna-sized small airplane drone that can fly for almost 24 hours. But the United States now has about 11,000 drones of all different types, and about 600 or so of this large type, and we're currently flying about 50 patrols a day. So that is all over the world. There are about 50 drones up in the sky at any one time, hunting for specific targets or surveilling large areas of landmass.
And you set us straight too on the concept of just aerial. There are other kinds of drones too that don't just fly.
There are many different kinds. When we say drone, generally in the common lexicon, we do mean aerial vehicles, though there are unmanned robots on the ground, and there are unmanned sea-borne vehicles today, but they're nowhere as mature or as significant as they are in the air. But the reality for the air is that drones have become so ubiquitous within the armed forces that from a number of maybe a couple of hundred at 9/11, we have 11,000 today, and of those 11,000, the vast majority of them are no larger than a remotely controlled airplane that a private individual might buy, and those are really the personal reconnaissance binoculars, if you will, of common soldiers on the ground, and that type of drone, the most common one of which is called the Raven, has pretty much proliferated into every unit in the U.S. military. So you have this combination of low-end and high-end, and that really is a reflection more of the evolution of the technology and the reduction in costs, but it also reflects the fact that the U.S. has become absolutely fascinated with the notion of targeting and targeted killing. And so the idea of being able to employ a drone, whether as an individual soldier or as the President of the United States, in finding and killing targets has now pretty much taken over as the dominant mode of operations of the U.S. government.
So it really would change the calculus on the battlefield completely. I mean, it just the whole idea of territory and lines and troops facing each other is sort of undone by the idea of these guys being able to launch Ravens and send them miles away to look for the people they want to shoot.
That's correct. Now, of course, you can take that sole technological approach and say, well, warfare is transformed. But really what my book evaluates is that warfare is warfare, and it will never be transformed. American warfare has been transformed, and one of the conundrums of the United States' embrace of unmanned vehicles and our embrace of air power in general has been that it has forced our adversaries to seek other ways of doing harm to us. And so when you begin to think about the evolution of air power followed by cruise missiles, which were shot in great plenty during the 1990s, and then drones, which became more and more prevalent after 9/11, each of them an instrument of remote warfare. At each stage along the way, our adversaries worked very hard to find counters, and the counters were not necessarily what they could do technologically to prevent or overcome our technology. It was more what could they do to hurt us in response to this remote form of warfare. And that's what we saw, I think, in the development of airliners as weapons in 9/11, or in the development of improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, car bombs, remotely controlled car bombs, that became prevalent after the invasion of Iraq. And today, various kinds of suicide truck bombings and other kinds of bombings, again, utilizing what we probably don't think of as drones, but in fact they are either human or mechanical drones used by our adversaries.
Well, and when you think about the asymmetricality of us coming up with all this high-tech warfare, and it was a couple of guys in a rubber boat that took out the coal in Yemen several years ago, it's a different kind of world with different kinds of tactics. We'll get into these in greater depth as we talk more with William M. Arkin, the author of Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. Back on the program with William M. Arkin and your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is William M. Arkin, the author of many books on American military and security issues. His latest is called Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. You can join our discussion as we talk about warfare from above with the drones and how they're being countered on the ground. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. William, you acknowledge the fears that people have of a Terminator-style planet where death can rain down on us from killing machines in the skies, but what's your own take on where we're likely headed with aerial drones in particular?
Well, I think my major concern these days is that we have created a targeted killing machine, and it's driven mostly by data, not so much by drones, that has in some ways reformed our military and our foreign policy so that we're really capable of doing one thing very well, which is going out and finding individuals and individual targets and killing them, and not really good at doing anything else, or at least we've given up on the notion that we should prepare for or wage warfare in other ways. So you see, for instance, in our campaign against ISIS, in Syria and Iraq, that the approach of the U.S. is to depend heavily upon air power and drones and not on boots on the ground. And I'm not saying that I favor boots on the ground. I'm merely saying that this has become our specialty. It's almost a no-brainer that the President of the United States would choose a targeting-oriented high-tech campaign, because that's exactly what we've built in our military over the past 15 years, reducing the number of troops and increasing the number of IT and intelligence workers. And so therefore, we have slowly become more and more expert at doing something, which also in the end influences then, therefore, what we choose to do.
Is it more the case of, you know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail? I mean, you got the tools, you want to use them, but is it also, how much of it is that, and how much of it is the political reality of the fact that America is really getting tired of sending troops into other countries?
Well, okay, so we are America, you and me, and the listeners of this radio station, and you got to admit, we're pretty remote from war. So the fact that the United States, our nation, fights remote warfare is not something that we should lament as something that's going on with somebody else's okay or financing. It's our okay and our financing. So I don't disagree with your argument or the premise of your question. It just seems to me that we have sort of created this conundrum, which is to say that we have said we want to have a technologically advanced capability within our military. We want to have a professional military, which means we don't want to have a draft. And coincidentally with that, and it's really the biggest point, technology has just massively transformed in the last decade or two. Everything that you can think about in your smartphone or your Kindle or your laptop has been achieved in the military in spades. And so things are smaller, things are cheaper, things work more readily, they work more regularly, they're more reliable. And so pieces of military equipment that the generals used to be skeptical about because they didn't know whether it was going to work or be robust enough or be strong enough to survive on a battlefield now have gotten to that point. So I don't think that I would characterize America as reluctant to fight, but I would say that because we fight in a certain way that isolates most people from the cost of war, then there's no cost to the government or to the military of fighting in that way. And so it's a kind of circular problem, which is to say that we don't really ask ourselves the basic question, is it making us safer? And instead we ask the question of how much does it cost or who is benefiting or even more weirdly, whether this technology works or doesn't work. And we're sort of evading the question of whether or not our waging war in this way achieves the goal of ultimate security. And if it doesn't achieve that goal, what stimuli is it providing for the world that's actually making things more dangerous?
William M. Arkin is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. I want to talk about some of the things that drones do that give us capabilities we didn't used to have. The loitering of drones is a term you use. This is something not possible for manned craft. What does it mean?
Well, basically, when you're talking about the difference between a large drone like Predator, Reaper, Global Hawk, and an airplane, you're talking about the difference of what it means to have a man on board. These large drones have nobody on board, and because they're built in a certain way, which is they have tremendously long wingspans, they're essentially gliding at very high altitudes with a motor. And this allows them to stay up there for an extremely long period of time. The Global Hawk drones, which are manufactured in California, are able to stay up in the air for almost 30 hours, and so there's just no way that either a manned airplane or a satellite can achieve the same goal. A satellite takes an orbit around the Earth, and so therefore it only looks at a certain spot on the globe every 90 minutes or so in its orbit, and an airplane is restricted by the ability of the crew. And so with the maturation of this generation of loitering drones, we now have the ability to place drones up in the air and use them to both watch and specifically to target individuals or target areas of interest for very long periods of time. And it is even the case now that it is a normal thing in an operation for a drone to be up there for almost a day and then to be relieved by another drone so that even 48 hours or 72 hours or 96 hours of coverage is uninterrupted. And so therefore anything that happens at a particular compound is constantly under one persistent eye. And that's a capability that just never existed in any way in the past.
You were limited by pilots and fuel and all the things that that do wear out after a time. I mean, pilots can't stay awake for 30 hours straight, but no problem for these little things. Are they visible from the ground? I mean, some of the smaller ones in particular. I mean, are the people being watched aware they're being watched?
In the cases of the larger drones, the answer is essentially no. In the early days, in the 1990s, when the early versions of Predator were flown in Bosnia and in the former Yugoslavia, there were lots of reports of people hearing drones more than they were of seeing them. And that's because at the time, the early generation drones were literally powered by a lawnmower engine. But today, those drones have become much quieter, and they fly at much higher altitudes. I mean, the Global Hawk drones fly at 65,000 feet. That's about double what a commercial airliner would fly at when it's at its highest altitude. So it's not even in commercial airspace. It's almost in near space. And so that's far out of the range of anyone's ability to detect. The Predators are probably flying closer to 20 to 25,000 feet. And though probably they can be detected on occasion, they're also surrounded by a whole system of air defenses and intelligence collection that ensures that they avoid areas of radar coverage or air defense coverage so that they are flying essentially invisible.
This whole concept of unmanned, though, I mean, there's nobody on board the drones themselves, but I have to wonder when you're talking about the support teams, you can, you know, in a 30-hour hovering, loitering campaign, you're going to have several different people who are going to be sitting at the controls operating this drone, I assume, and probably some other support staff, repair people, et cetera. So, I mean, does each drone have a deep team of people behind it?
It does. And in fact, one of the things that really began to surprise the military as they adopted the use of drones more and more after 9/11 just was how manpower intensive they were. So that while the instrument itself didn't require a pilot, there was a pilot and a sensor operator on the ground, and then there were probably a dozen more analysts who were reviewing the video and electro-optical imagery, synthetic aperture imagery, and other kinds of images that were returned. And then on top of that, there were the people who were operating the pipelines of communications back and forth from, let's say, a drone that's flying from the ground in Pakistan over Afghanistan, transmitting its data to a satellite in space, which is then transmitting it to a ground station in Europe, which is then transmitting it to a satellite in space, which is then transmitting it to a ground station in England, which is then transmitting the data via submarine cable to the United States, which is then transmitting it to a teleport in the U.S. and transmitting it via internet over to the analysts who are looking at the satellite or the imagery take. And so you're talking about, in fact, thousands upon thousands of people in what I call the data machine who are now supporting not just drones, but our fleet of satellites, our fleet of manned reconnaissance aircraft, and all of the NSA collection that takes place through cyber means, all of which is essentially feeding the same objective, and that has created a vast network of hubs of communications and analysis, most of which are in the United States, that are now really the back end of the drone. And so what we've seen, it's hard to give you exact figures, but maybe, let's say, during the Vietnam War or even during the first Gulf War Desert Storm in 1990, the ratio of soldiers to intelligence people was probably 100 to 1, 100 soldiers for every one mm-hmm. intelligence person. Today, the ratio is almost exactly opposite. There are 100 intelligence people for every soldier. And so that combination of IT workers, communications people, contractors, analysts, processors, storers, those people are the dominant force in the U.S. military and in the U.S. intelligence community, and that in itself has also transformed the economy. It's transformed the way the military is organized. It's transformed where it's based and what it can be.
which requires us to think about the numbers of people and dollars we've got tied up in a war against people who are still using rubber boats and truck bombs. Unmanned is the title of William M. Arkin's book. We're talking about aerial warfare and just our general concept of modern warfare here on the Jefferson Exchange. And you can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about Gilgamesh now and why that name is used throughout the book.
Well, when I discovered that one of the top secret black box devices attached to drones was called Gilgamesh, and it's a particular device which is used to intercept and geolocate cell phone signals from the ground, it fascinated me that someone would have either the historic irony or a knowledge to name it Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh, of course, is a Sumerian king and mythic figure, sort of the first figure of world literature, if you will. And I started to become fascinated with why Gilgamesh was being used, because he was Iraqi-based. Gilgamesh started in Iraq. He was a king that was supposedly two parts human and one part god. And he was a rapacious ruler who essentially, through much trial and tribulation, learned that mankind could not be immortal, and as a result of that, restored the rules of modern living, including the rules of warfare, after the deluge, after the flood, and this is a pre-biblical figure. So to me, it seemed ironic that Gilgamesh was sort of one of the silver bullets that was invented in order to go and kill terrorists, and yet it also came to represent to me that this machine and all of its various black boxes had no interest in or no knowledge of the particular geography or culture in which it was fighting, that the people who were operating the drones could be in Somalia one day, Yemen the next, Afghanistan the next, Iraq the next, Syria the next, Nigeria the next, Libya the next. To them, a target was a target, and the locality and the culture and the peoples on the ground were virtually irrelevant or even immaterial, and so it seemed like we were taking on the same kind of godlike view of the early Gilgamesh king, and yet hadn't come to grips yet with our own immortality and the fact that we probably needed to be on the ground if we really wanted to wage warfare in such a way that we would be having any opportunity of restoring peace between warring peoples, which, of course, is the very definition of a just war.
So does the hardware drive the process? I mean, are we no longer thinking in terms of human beings other than as targets when we wage war this way, but were we when we did it the other way?
I think that the technology does drive things, and we saw that really clearly last year when the United States began its military campaign against ISIS. You know, six times in his primetime speech, President Obama referred to ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. So this is military jargon, and he's talking to the American people and saying, well, you know, the first thing we need to do is get the intelligence. And it's like, wait a minute here, get the intelligence for what? I mean, we spend $70 billion a year on our national intelligence community. Are you telling me what have they been looking at, Mars for the last 10 years? So the President of the United States, in justifying increasing military activity against ISIS, is essentially talking about priming the machine to be able to do what its job is, which is to target these individuals. So very much the technology has begun to influence how we operate and the limitations of how we operate. And I don't think, again, that the answer is that anybody wants to return to the day of industrial warfare and the grinding warfare of World War II or World War I. You know, one of the things I've said to people in various lectures I've given is to remind them that in 14 years of warfare since 9/11, maybe 300,000 people have died total. That's civilians, military, People who have died in terrorist attacks, people who have died as a result of so-called collateral damage, 300,000 total, okay? That could have been a bad day in World War I or World War II.
True.
So this is 14 years of warfare. And so we have, quote, made improvements, but the question is, are we waging wars that we have the possibility of ending? And, of course, that is the very definition of just war, that you have to wage the war in such a way so that the end result of that war is that you can restore peace between warring peoples.
All right, we'll pick this up on the other side of a break. Lots more to talk about here with William M. Arkin, the author of Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. Obviously, perfect warfare can't be possible if it is an illusion. We'll get more of what William's talking about and get some of your responses in here as well via phone and email. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back. William Arkin and Unmanned and you in a minute tourney. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is William Arkin, who spent 40 years in national security, starting with an Army intelligence posting in West Berlin. He has worked for the New York Times, the Washington Post. He's written a number of books, including American Coup and Top Secret America, co-authored with Dana Priest. He's the author of a new book called Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about drones and the modern way we wage warfare from the American side. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the idea of a war that we can bring to a conclusion, that we get to a peaceful resolution between parties, it's interesting to think in terms of that versus previous wars where we had clear objectives when we started. We had declarations of war by Congress, which we don't have anymore either. So they don't really begin anymore. And President Bush warned us during the beginnings of what was called the war on terrorism at that time that this is not going to be the war that ends with a ceremony on the deck of a battleship like World War II did. In your view, William Arkin, do they ever end?
Well, I think that it's ironic that if you go back to the first statements of President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney after 9/11 and trying to describe what was unfolding in Afghanistan, that they were pretty accurate in saying that this was a war that was going to take place in the shadows and that it was going to take a long time. I think that they had a probably pretty accurate view of what it might take to eliminate al-Qaeda as an organization that's a threat to the United States. I just don't think that they ever really had a very clear understanding of the of who they were fighting against or what the nature of the concerns and aggrievements of those who were fighting against us were. And of course, since 9/11, we've had dozens of different types of new organizations which have emerged, and they all seem to have the same a basic worldview, which is that the West is trying to destroy Islam, or at least to subjugate Islam to Western needs and requirements and economic requirements, and so they want to establish a pure Islamic state, or they want to defeat the West, or whatever their political objectives might be. But one thing is clear is that this early articulation of this long war wasn't wrong. It was just that we didn't really understand what was going to unfold as that war became more and more dominated by our technology versus really the old-fashioned carnage of the opposing side. And in fact, we have not seen a diminishment in the number of casualties that are being caused by terrorists. Boko Haram in Nigeria has mounted some of the deadliest terrorist incidents in modern history since 9/11. And there have been other deadly attacks in Iraq that have exacted hundreds of civilian deaths. So it's not like the carnage of war has equally gone down on both sides. And yet at the same time, you can't really point to a particular area of the world or a particular theater in which we're fighting in which you could say that the situation is getting much better. That would beg me to ask the question, well, what can we do to make the situation better? Or what is it that our strategy is that might be in itself creating the stimuli to manufacture more people who hate us?
Well, and so what would be some of the answers here? Because, you know, even without technology, you can get into a situation where you're just constantly at war, witness the Israelis and the Palestinians and rocket lobbings and all that goes on there. Not a high-tech war like what we're talking about here, but the general sense that if you kill our guys, we're going to kill your guys, and it just keeps going on and on and on. And obviously within the whole military establishment, there's not a lot of thinking about the sociology and anthropology and what are these people like, what are their needs. They're really not supposed to care, I suppose you could make the case. But then how do you get a larger view in the political system when you've got the presidents, two in a row now, really enjoying the hardware and using the terminology?
Well, I think that you have precisely said it, that it is two presidents, so it's across the political spectrum. And we do seem to be unable to influence exactly what it is that the military should be doing. The military and the intelligence community is more or less setting their own agenda. I don't think that that's particularly a bad thing if we're not able to set the agenda for them, but I think we've gotten to the point now where a decade and a half after 9/11, we can start to ask ourselves these questions, and that's partly why I wrote this book. And I would have to say to you, maybe with some my head held in shame, that I don't have an easy answer, but I do have a better picture of how it is that the development of these technologies and the development of our insatiable appetite for information has influenced the unfolding of this mode of warfare that has become so dominant for us right now. But clearly, we are not able as a people to ask one of the fundamental questions that our ongoing wars in this part of the world wants us to ask, which is, are we at war with Islam? And until we can answer that question honestly, I don't think that we are going to be able to persuade enough people in that part of the world to be our allies. And so the existence of terrorist organizations and of quasi-state organizations and their support from the people comes because they don't see themselves being supported by the state actors of that region, hence the Arab Spring and hence a lot of other regimes which are not democratic in that part of the world. And so we sort of have this divide, and it seems to me like the United States just hasn't figured out what it is that our grand strategy might be. What do we want in the end? I mean, do we want in the end just a whole set of Saddam Husseins and autocratic regimes that are going to keep people who don't agree with our culture and our way of life in line? Or do we want true democracy? And when true democracy has been practiced in the Middle East, say, for instance, in Algeria in the early 2000s, and Islamists overwhelmingly won in free elections, the military took over. And so we have to ask ourselves what exactly it is we're trying to achieve. And if all we're trying to achieve is to ensure that the United States proper doesn't get hit with another 9/11, then even there, I would say, we haven't done a very good job with the Boston Marathon and other attacks that have taken place, so that who is being held accountable for even the small goal, let alone who is being held accountable now, 7 years into a Democratic administration, for a larger scale strategic goal in which the Democrats would like people to believe that they're completely different than the Republicans, and yet are national security strategy has been one seamless war since 2001.
A couple of contacts from listeners here. Jay in Walterville writes emails that are probably easier for the eye than to hear on the radio, but I'll read this one. It says, of drones, he writes, the new tool, real estate, remote resources, rule and riches, wars. That is the definition of American interest. We need an Orwellian prevention, analysis, and solution. Drones are great. Use? With 5 question marks. And then on to John in Grants Pass on the phone. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with William Arkin, the author of Unmanned.
Hi. This reminds me so much of the Terminator movies. I want your guests to comment on that. You know, and obviously we know in Terminator, the government built this, not just a computer system, but I think in Terminator 3, they have these hover, they sort of look like a hover, I don't know what they are, but they're basically a robot, they're obviously robot things, and they built robots, you know, too, robot soldiers and all that. And so is that really realistic? Are most of our, in the future, most of our planes can be unmanned? I mean, and I just want you to comment on the movie, because it kind of follows, I think, exactly what you're talking about. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, John.
Well, I think that science fiction is often a very good sign for us of the way things are going, or the way we imagine things going. And to me, what makes the Terminator movies so realistic is this notion of a regenerating system. And that regenerating system, whether it's driven by men or driven solely by machines, is still a system that is going to replenish itself. So we have a regenerating system essentially on both sides, which is to say that we have a Pentagon and an intelligence community, which is essentially operating autonomously and with very little intervention, maybe just a little bit around the edges as to what color it's going to be, but not much more than that. And then we have a system of terrorism on the other side, which no matter what we do, no matter how many lieutenants we kill, no matter how many commanders we kill, no matter how many foot soldiers we kill, no matter how many suicide bombers there are, they always seem to regenerate more. And so I can't think of anything that's more autonomous than what we have right now, which is to say that there seems to be very little human intervention. And in that regard, it's very science fiction.
All right, so another case of fiction and reality and where they cross over. I mean, for all the many, many TV shows and movies we've seen where the president and the cabinet sit around looking at the war efforts going on in real time and video, do drones actually have these capabilities, most of them now?
Yes, they do. And it's still amazing to me as I have visited military bases to see how the video and the real-time intelligence so mesmerizes commanders and mesmerizes people at all levels and all echelons. This is an unprecedented world. And so in the same way that it's very hard for you to walk through an airport or a dentist's office or anywhere without glancing at the television that's on or stopping and seeing what the picture is, that's also the world of the military today. And there's hundreds of channels to watch and hundreds of different dramas being played out. And I do believe that to some degree that the imagery itself is a driving factor, because there's a greater degree, a sense of greater precision and greater human involvement. After all, if I, the President of the United States, can actually see the compound that my SEALs are attacking in Pakistan to kill bin Laden while it's happening, then what would give me a greater sense of feeling of my personal and human involvement in that endeavor? And so it creates this idea and this illusion of personal involvement, but in fact you're sitting in your office safely in Washington, D.C. doing this. And the people on the ground and people all over the planet who are mainly victims of terror or victims of inequality or inequity or oppression, you know, they don't have that. And so we have this kind of televised illusion of both precision and personal involvement. But I think it also at the same time presents a very distorted view of then, therefore, what we're trying to achieve.
So any change in this, and there are people who call for it across this country, any change in the use of drones and our approach to warfare would have to come from within the political system. We do have a presidential campaign coming up. We are actually in one now. I can't imagine any presidential candidate even making a peep on this subject, though, because they would instantly be labeled weak. And in that political landscape, how does anybody try to affect a change in what we're doing?
Well, I do think that people are a little bit tired of the war on terrorism. I don't particularly see national security being, you know, Democrats are weak, Republicans are strong, being the issue that's going to emerge in this campaign. So to me, there's greater opportunity for some nuance that says, okay, how do we make the world a better place? Because we've now had 16 years of Democrats and Republicans, and nobody seems to feel safer. But I think that you're right in saying that it's unlikely that we're going to see somebody come out and say, end the war on terrorism, let alone reduce our reliance upon autonomous systems and drones. There are some campaigns that are beginning against killer robots. That is the idea that robots would have the ability to make the decision to kill someone without human intervention. But I don't have any sense that there's anyone in the U.S. military who desires that to be the outcome. But they do desire to be able to kill the enemy without putting themselves or their men and women in uniform at risk. And I don't disagree that that isn't a good design for a military, but it is not the best design necessarily for winning or for resolving the war on terror.
The book is very thought-provoking and very detailed as well. We've only scratched the surface. There are just pages and pages of acronyms and weapon systems you never even heard of. William Arkham catches it all in the book Unmanned. Thanks so much for joining us today in the Jefferson Exchange.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
All right, take care.